Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Estella Rasmus. She's an award-winning journalist. She's a writing coach. She's an adjunct instructor at NYU. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Independent, Wired, and the Huffington Post. She's also appeared on Good Morning America, Fox News, Fox Network, and she's host of the Freelance Writing Direct podcast, which is found on her site, which is a really nice site, and on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, just like this thing is. So her latest book is Writing That Gets Noticed. It was published by New World Library earlier this year. So welcome, Estella. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on your program, Sam. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Oh, great. Me too. So first of all, I love your last name, Erasmus, because he's this Dutch, as you know, a Dutch philosopher who wrote In Praise of Folly, which was something I read when I was a kid, and I thought it was great. It was funny. It really helped me. You know, you talk about bookstores, it really helped me get into the idea of literature.
I love that. Yes, I married into that name, but I own it and it works for me.
Is it a Dutch name or is it, I think it's derived from the Greek. I don't know.
My husband is Dutch South African.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Interesting. Well, okay. A good way to start, because a good portion of your book is devoted to it and the people who are reading it probably are interested in a career. They're excited about their own writing. But the key to getting it out there is the pitch. And you talk a lot about the pitch. And I could say to you, okay, what is a pitch? And why would you make a pitch? And who would you make a pitch to? Those are good questions to start out with.
They are great questions. So the way I look at it, Sam, is working with an editor or getting an editor's attention is a confidence game. It's getting them to have confidence in you, especially when they don't know who you are. They don't know your work, or maybe you don't even have a body of work. So pitching them, if you're doing an article, or even pitching them with an essay, and an essay usually needs to be fully completed so they can see the way the twists and turns, the narrative arc. But for this purposes, pitching for an article, you have to show them that you are going to be able to deliver on the promise that you're making in the pitch, which is you have an idea that's fresh and new. Editors see everything. So, and I've been an editor for many publications, and you just get so used to seeing a lot of the similar types of pitches. Everyone wants to write about death or grief or divorce or marriage or parenting, but you have to have a spin. So I talk in my book about how you can build kind of that template to connect you, your interests, and what's going on in the news in a way that can create this compelling pitch that has a great title, that includes the things we learned in high school, the who, what, when, where, and hi, and how, not hi, how, and who you're going to use as your experts. And I have a big section in my book, as you know, talking about how to vet experts and find experts. And your Uncle Jim, who's a realtor, is probably not going to be as good an expert, especially if you're trying to get a piece in the New York Times, as somebody who is the head of a real estate association or organization who has written a book about real estate. First of all, for a newspaper, you can't be connected to the person. But in general, the higher the level that the person has risen to in their own professional field, that makes them a more credible expert. So editors are looking at all of that. And that's something that I teach my students at NYU, and I teach my students for Writer's Digest and for coaching. And so the book, I wanted to be able to kind of distill my three decades of experience as somebody on both sides of the publishing wall, as an assigning editor, an editor-in-chief, somebody who sees everything, and a very well-published journalist and essayist myself who also teaches. So I distilled it all in the book.
It's funny, one of the sections which really struck home to me, because I've always thought about this, is what's attributed to Hemingway, but I don't think is Hemingway, is baby shoes for sale, never worn. And it's got a beginning, it's got an arc, it's got a middle, it's got an end, and it's could make you cry. And you talk about, you know, it's like if you have diabetes too, and you get an email that says cure for diabetes too, you will look at that email. And you talk a little bit about that 6-word pitch.
Yes. So that's something that I start with my students, like getting them kind of into the flow of writing and coming up with ideas. I ask them to create like a 6-word memoir of themselves, you know, and so they put something together. Like that was sort of like a 6-word memoir that Hemingway did. And so that gets them to start thinking about who they are and how they want to portray themselves if they're writing memoir or if they're writing micro memoir, which I talk about in the book as well. And it's just a great idea generation technique. Really, you know, think about how you can distill who you are. I think I said something like about midlife mom or something, you know, finding self in midlife, something like that. Finding myself in motherhood. I forget what I wrote, but it's in the book. And so it's a great exercise to kind of get you started on figuring out who you are, especially if you're writing essays, because essays are all about the personal, but you don't want to reveal everything. So I kind of talk about how to conceal while you also reveal. It's not, because I know people who have blown up their life for a byline. You know, if they were getting divorced, they wrote about how they wanted to beat their kids, or they beat their kids and that was used against them. Or, oh, this happened during the pandemic. People would say that they were breaking the law just because they had to go to some store in a other place of town and they weren't supposed to go because they were on curfew or something. And I said, no, don't do anything that the authorities are going to be chasing after you for.
It's funny, you know, at the bookstore, I'm always mindful of the fact that the books that I recommend and the books that people like are the books that when you're done, you're still asking questions. When you're done, you're thinking about what's going to happen. And going back to the Hemingway thing, when you read that, you think, okay, what happened afterwards? Did they get divorced? Did they mourn? You have these thoughts going through your head, and a lot of what you're talking about, like what's the difference between your pitch and if you're pitching a movie before an executive? Is it the same thing exactly, or does it have nuances that are different?
It's probably a little bit different because for a movie pitch, and I don't know the movie business that well, but they do like a log line, like a one line thing. And for a pitch, like an article pitch or even a reported essay, you still have to give a little bit more information, like about 3 paragraphs worth of information rather than you can't always distill it into one sentence. You could if it's a pop culture thing, like baby name, you know, the weirdest baby names I ever thought of, right? Like or that are popular now. That could be probably a one-line pitch. If you're writing about medical or health stuff, there's a little bit of an explainer in there that you need to support to show the editor why you want to write that. But so many people write like pop culture pitches. You know, Naomi Campbell had a baby at 51. Well, I had a baby in midlife, and here's why science supports that kind of stuff. And that is easier to do in a very short pitch.
Actually, that brings me to something that I always find intriguing. Usually it's, obviously the cover of your book is good. It's sitting right there, which is great. That's smart. Authors don't do that. It's a great cover. And as a bookseller, you know what? People judge books by their cover, and they do. And the second thing I look at is epigraphs. And you don't have an epigraph as such, but what you do have is at the beginning of each chapter, you have a quote, most of whom are from people I admire. A couple of them are like Orson Scott Card or people that I've interviewed. And so the first one is a really good one. I might go through a bunch of these because it really highlights what you wrote, is Joan Didion, where she writes, and you talk about this, to find out, you know, not necessarily to get a book that says $29.95 on the inside flap, but in order to actually think, okay, this is me. What am I thinking inside? Let me write it so I know.
Yes. The quote is, I write entirely to find out what I'm thinking, what I'm looking at, what I see, and what it means. And you're right. It, you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because it was really important to me, Sam, to have these quotes, you know, because this is a book for writers, who people want to write, whatever stage they're at. They could be retirees, they could be somebody who wants to learn how to write for college, for their profession, who wants to be a professional writer, who wants to start getting those clips. So they have to understand, like, a lot of the philosophy of the writer's life. And, you know, with my three decades in publishing, I understand it, and I wanted to share that. And so Joan Didion says, you know, it's almost like journaling, right? And I do talk about journaling as well in the book, because you're writing to kind of observe and make sense of the world a lot of times. And sometimes people find their own conclusions through what they're writing, and they never really realize. People say this to me all the time. I wrote this essay and it was a huge catharsis when I came to the end of it, because I showed that I was in a different place from where I started to where I ended.
And also, it kind of also says, you know, even though you're writing a book for people who want to get published, it doesn't have to be about the money. It can be about the person you are and self-discovery process, which is great. And the thing about the epigraphs is, the reason why I always like them is because when you read one at the beginning of a chapter, it's like looking at the outside cover of a jigsaw puzzle. And because, you know, there's the picture of what it's going to look like at the end. But then you go in to put the pieces together.
Absolutely. I love that. And I, you know, I wanted to do a variety of quotes that people from the whole spectrum, you know, the very esoteric, the very erudite, to just the pop culture people.
Yeah, well, you moved on from Joan Didion to Rumi, and it's kind of a really good segue, because it's kind of the obverse in a way, but a corollary. You know, what his was like, you know, when you're walking the way appears. Yeah. And it's, that's somewhat like a bookend to Joan Didion's. That, okay, she's saying get started. And he's saying, once you get started, don't worry.
Yes. And I talk, and it's sort of like a correlation to writer's block, right? Because I talk about that in the book, how to break it and how to use. I'm a big believer in science in a very reader friendly way, not a highfalutin, you know, here's the study, but to break it down. And so I give examples of why it works when you're in water and in the shower and you come up with these ideas. You know, people always say that, but they didn't really understand there is a science behind it. You know, it does stimulate the beta patterns of the brain, which is a more, you know, takes information in and puts it out.
If you're taking a walk with your dog and you have your iPhone, just say, go to voice record and just start talking. It doesn't have to, like you said, it can be crap. It doesn't make any difference if it's crap. You're just doing it.
The only thing I would say is
I'm different than you is I wouldn't take off time to binge Real Housewives.
Oh my God. We definitely differ. To me, it's like, I don't know. It's taking a mental margarita. I think I can.
it would make me physically ill.
My husband is with you. So I hear you completely.
The next one, I guess, is Orson Scott Card. And he was like this when I talked to him. He's talking about, you know, everybody every day sees or hears 1,000 stories. And he says, just pick a couple. And I was at the beach in Stone Harbor, New Jersey. And I was just walking along. And some guy goes, I would never snitch on Pablo. And I thought, oh, you can do something with that. And then there's these two old ladies walking along. And one of them goes, if this is the last summer of my life, I thought, okay.
Wow. That's a great opening line. Whatever she's going to write. Wow. I love it. For a book, for anything.
Yeah. Well, like James Joyce, like in Ulysses and the Night Town episode, all he did basically, and I do this sometimes too, is go to bars, sit next to people and write down what they say. generally it's better than dialogue that you would write.
Absolutely. That's how you kind of put your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the zeitgeist and the culture. What are people talking about? What are people angry about? What do you hear someone ranting about at the gym to their friend? Those are the things that probably are going to be of interest to editors because they're looking at social media. They're looking at Reddit. I mean, half the stories now in the New York Times have some element where they're citing a TikTok. I mean, this is really true. This is because it's a primary source, right? Somebody on TikTok, you see the person, it's not through a secondary person. So you're getting someone's quotes that you can directly use. It's a primary source. And the other thing is that they are, you know, it's theirs. So there's no issue with ownership.
Yeah. Now, Elon Musk, who already controls the world anyway, now that Twitter is X and the Pope still has a Twitter account, which is amazing because he's going through Elon Musk, who I love, but who's getting increasingly wacko. You know, Twitter is, in a sense, the world. I mean, you talk on Twitter. I never do, but most of the people.
I'll tell you, Sam, editors are still on Twitter. I mean, I know people are leaving in droves. I used to have 300 new people follow me a day or a week, or I don't even remember, but you know, I've been at like 15,000 for a while now. And I think that there's been changes, a lot of changes on Twitter. I don't know where it's going to go. For now, I'm on it because editors are on it. And we'll see. We will see.
The thing about what you were saying about ranting and raving, for good or for bad, in our society today, there's very little civil discourse. So there's lots of fodder and fuel for the things now because everyone's yelling at each other. And there's another thing, I talk too much, but there's another thing, which is that if people write a book about what they think, say politically, the people who read it are the people who think the same way. The other people are not going to read it, just like they're not going to watch Saturday Night Live if they're Trumpers. But so I tell prospective authors, write as if you see the viewpoint of the other person. It doubles your audience.
No, that's good advice. And I would also say to somebody, whatever you write, be prepared when you unleash something on the world. You have to be prepared for the world to respond back. And people don't sometimes seem to get that. You know, they're just going to say, I'm going to write about anything I want because it's my voice. But in today's world, you have to be conscious of that. So, you know, you may choose certain niche topics that you want to write about, and that's fine. But if you are going to write about something more incendiary, then you have to be prepared for it. And that's a different conversation.
Yeah, there's two things, you know, people in glass houses. Well, we're all in glass houses now, and you better be thick skinned or it ain't going to happen.
Absolutely. I wrote My Child is Out of Control for the Washington Post. She was, what, 5, 6 years old at the time. And people were writing in the comments that Child Protective Services should come and take my daughter away. I'm clearly not a good mother. I clearly don't know how to handle her. And I was just, you know, being in the industry, this is where I think perspective and experience helps, because I've been in the industry so long that I've seen so much happen and I am thick skinned. You know, I trust my friends, I trust my colleagues, I trust the people who are in the trenches with me to understand. I don't necessarily am going to take the opinion of some random person who is reading me. So for example, like if you go to Times Square and somebody ran up to you and said, I'm going to tell you how you can fix your life, your marriage, your career, would you listen to that person?
I don't know.
Okay, so then why are people listening to people?
You're in Times Square. It could be a minion. And I don't want to go, I don't want my kids or anybody going near a minion because I don't know who's inside.
Okay. Oh, I've had minion experiences. So, well, that's a separate conversation. But no, really, they were like trying to put their hands around my daughter. And yeah.
I know. So, and you know, if their minion suit is a little dirty or shabby,
You have to look. Yeah. And I didn't know that at first. I thought, oh, how cute. You know, they're hired by, you know, the... no, they weren't. All right. So anyway, the fact of the matter is that I wrote this. I wrote about this for Wired, actually. I said, on social media, sometimes you just, you know, sometimes you just have to shut up. And the thing is, you don't argue with somebody who is telling you a horrible comment to your article or your essay. You don't fight with the trolls. That's really what you don't do. But you have to be thick-skinned. Yeah, like I've had friends say, I don't know how you could write about, you know, your daughter not sleeping in your bed. And, you know, because all the people who were really advocates for that came really strong. And again, I'm a horrible mother. I'm not really writing that much parenting these days because she's a teenager. And teenagers, you know, don't touch anything about my, you know, my area in life at this point is her feeling.
Just do not. The thing about it is that, say for the bookstore, our Yelp reviews are great. We have like a 4.8, but we have two really bad Yelp reviews and they were plants. They were trolling. There was something about us they didn't like. So there's two bad ones. And I find it's better to have a couple bad ones because when you read them, you know, they're idiots and you know, that someone must be good. If you have like 100 good ones and one bad one, you know, that person's a nitwit.
Yeah. It's sort of like there's no such thing as bad publicity in a way. I mean, that's the old Barnum Bailey, you know, tenet. But yeah. And, you know, by the way, you're a prominent bookstore. And so you're going to, you know, get some slings and arrows because of that.
It's scary because if they created an army of them, we could easily be out of business like you're talking about. It's scary.
Well, people also have their own taste. And so you have to rely, you know, you have to know that people can see quality. That's, you know, really the best way, I think, to look at these things.
Yeah, that reminds me of something about the book that I don't think you talked about, but this idea of word of mouth for like a book talk. Word of mouth is why my bookstore has people in it. I used to take out advertisements in newspapers. It was stupid. It was a lot of money. It was meaningless.
Yeah.
But when someone comes and they like it, they tell 10 people.
Absolutely. It's building a reputation for quality work, quality product. And that's really, you know, how it evolves.
If we move on the quotes, and this ties into it too, is the Tom Clancy one, which is basically, I'm not going to say a different word, but tell the damn story. And it's true. You don't want to pussyfoot around what you're writing about. Just sit down and tell it. Get your coffee, get your computer, and get your pencil and paper and just do it.
Yeah. The more emotionally honest that you can be about telling your story, the better. Again, you don't have to give every single incriminating detail. You just have to set up if you're writing an essay, a narrative arc. You start in a certain place. You use sensual language, and I mean language of the senses, touch, taste, hearing, smelling, to describe something. You don't want to say, my date picked me up in his car. You want to say, my date picked me up in his car with a broken fender with popcorn in the leather seat. That gives a clue to the character. Or my date picked me up in his sleek Porsche with trim on the, like, that is giving information. And so sharing those details in that description while you're building the narrative arc, and then ending, you transform. I call it leaving the reader with a gift. You show that you're different in thought, in ideology, in, like, you're a different person at the end of the essay, whether it's a long essay or a short essay, and a book works for that too, a memoir, than you are in the beginning. And that is compelling writing and compelling reading.
Well, when you're talking about memoir, And I guess along the lines of my date picked me up, the William Zinsser quote says basically writing in the person is first person is the way to go. And why do you put that in there? Do you agree with that? You must think that.
For memoir, absolutely. I do agree. I mean, I know there's some that are third person, absolutely, but I do feel Third person is harder to pull off with memoir if you are not a known quantity, if you're not a celebrity. You know, you could probably do it if you're known. First person creates more of an emotional connection between the person writing and the reader. It's sort of like there's no middleman. The third person sort of creates this impartial middleman feeling. And so that directness is right there. So I do believe that.
And, you know, it's funny. I don't even know if you thought about when you wrote these epigraphs, but they all lead into one another. Did you realize you were doing that?
Well, you know, I did structure the book, but I can't exactly say that I structured the epigraphs, but I did structure the book. And so I guess you can say that, right? Because I had to very carefully cull through thousands of quotes for each section. And this is talking about how I prepared the book, but in the beginning, when I was putting the book together, I kind of had my 7 potential quotes for each section. And as the section developed, I saw which quote would fit better. And so that's how I did it.
Well, yeah. And the next one is Joyce Carol Oates. And it's basically, which I think is the hardest thing, is you can't write the first sentence until you write the last sentence. I hate that, because I always think of the first sentence and I think, okay, now I'll be able to write the story. It's not a good way to go.
I have to say that sometimes I have these miracle moments. And again, I think it's just being doing this for so long on both sides, is that the perfect first sentence of an essay will come to me, right? But again, it has to flow, it has to make sense. And I talk about something in the book about circling back at the end of an essay, which is pulling something in from the beginning of the essay and showing it in a different way. It's almost like the idea of like objective correlative, which is an item that stands in for emotions. So I analyze a modern love in my book after, I think, 365 haircuts of marriage ends that William Dameron wrote. And the idea is the haircuts stand in for the emotion of the marriage. He's a gay man who was married for many years and he discovers his gayness and leaves the marriage, but the haircuts represent the emotional connection between him and his wife. And so if you bring in some element, whatever it is, in the beginning of an essay, and then you circle back at the end, maybe you're talking about time and parenting, and then you're giving examples of what that parenting is like, you know, and why time is so fleeting. And then you would pull time in as the element in the end and circle back to something you said in the beginning, maybe with a new perspective or a new point of view or something that's going to make the reader think beyond the last word of the essay.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying earlier. I couldn't put it better, because you know, I know people who come into the bookstore and they want a book that is, when they're done, it's wrapped up, it's in gift wrap, it's got a on it, and they're done. And I hate those kinds of books. I want a book, like you said, that after the last word is read, you go off on your own. The cover's closed, but you're still in the book. You're still in the writer's world. And it's hard to do, but I think it's much more satisfying.
I love it. I mean, as you know, if you read the book, and I know you read the book, I, you know, worked in a library when I was a teenager. I got fired for reading on the job because I just would get immersed in the world of books. And I used it in my career.
I can't fire my staff if they're reading something that doesn't allow me to do that. I will yell at them, but I won't fire them.
Well, maybe they're coming up with ideas for events or different aspects. Yeah,
I like when they get up and go out from behind the counter and go to the front door and clean it. That's what I like. Because if they don't have something to do, think of what to do. And that's probably how you've lived your life too.
Yeah, it's a job. I mean, you have to, each job, there's going to be good facets and bad facets. It's the same thing with writing. I mean, some people just cannot get their butt in the seat, right? They have to do the Pomodoro technique, or they have to treat themselves with like a chocolate afterwards, or, you know, but the idea is nothing's going to get done. nothing's going to get published if you don't sit down and write. So you just got to start.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because as we're talking, I was thinking of the next quote, which was from Dale Carnegie. But I thought of Dale Carnegie's other quote, which is, the most beautiful sound to a person is the sound of his own name. So you, when you say Sam or I say Estelle, it makes it such, see, you're acknowledging my existence and that I'm a valuable resource for you, or that we're friends or something like that. And I think that's also part of the pitch.
When you're saying talking, or you're saying writing, like to the editor, what do you mean there? Because I agree with what you're saying. But well, yeah,
both ways. But I would say in a book,
yeah,
a certain kind of book, if you feel as if the author is actually speaking directly to you and you find that you're lost in that, it makes it's a very interesting experience and a pleasant one for the most part.
Absolutely. And the same could be correlated to if you're, I say in the book, if you're sending a pitch to an editor, editors are people too. They're not like, you know, God sitting up on Mount Olympus, even though people look at them that way. They are engaged in a career. They may be writing a book. They are writing for their publication. They're writing for other publications. Like you said, they want to be acknowledged. So when you're sending a pitch, compliment something that they've recently run, or something that they've worked on or written themselves. Because I can't even tell you how many times somebody would just send me a pitch like, I'd like to write this. Okay. But if they said, hey, I read your piece in the New York Times and I loved it, and it made me think of this, that, I'm already much more engaged. I'm like, okay, they see me. I want to be seen. They see me.
One of the rules that I didn't make up, but I read a long time ago, and it's worked really effectively, is if you have a complaint about a product, the first paragraph you say, I've enjoyed your product so much over the years. It's made a big difference in my life. However, or but in this instant, but if you make that first paragraph a compliment, it changes the whole aspect of their interpretation of the letter.
Because you're setting it up that you appreciate what they're offering, but here is your issue. And you've already elevated yourself. I love the word elevated, because you've elevated and brought yourself up to a different level in their eyes. And that's, you know, all about getting noticed, right, Sam?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Getting noticed. Everything you're saying is great. However, editors, publishers are going to get thousands of things going through their desk, and some of it they put in that slush pile that they may go back to. But so the first, if you're going to talk about pitches, if you're going to talk about getting published, the first thing is, how do I make sure that they actually look at what I've written rather than just toss it?
So the first, think about it, when the editor is sitting there, nobody sends anything snail mail anymore, right? So it's all email. Yeah. So they are going to click on their computer and they're going to see a subject line. So they're going to be getting PR pitches, you know, cover this in your magazine. They're going to be getting freelance writing pitches from freelance writer, I'm pitching your magazine or your publication. But if you have a tantalizing title and you're putting it in the subject line and you're also saying you're a freelance writer, that is going to get their attention.
It's not easy to do, you know. You're making it sound like it's easy.
No, but okay. You still have to support it with knowing how to pitch, because even if you have a great subject line, the editor can be like, oh, that's interesting, but then the pitch could be a dud. But when I pitched the New York Times for How to Bullyproof Your Child, that was the title I put in there. I said, you know, freelance writer pitching How to Bullyproof Your Child, and that got the editor to open the email. And then I was able to support it with the pitch and showing that I knew my material, and I was starting with an anecdote. And there are other ways. So let's say the editor's opening it and they have never worked with you before and they don't know who you are. You can do something called writing to the reader, which is writing the first paragraph of the pitch as if it is the actual article. And that's always helpful if it's like starts with an anecdote or something, because it shows the editor that you know how to write. and they can see your writing style. And again, remember what I said when we first started talking, Sam, it's a confidence game. It's getting the editor to have confidence that they are going to take their time, their energy, their beloved publication, and give you a chance in it, because they know, they sense that you will be able to deliver.
You know, there's so many books in my bookstore now, and there's so many that I don't get that are about, say, autism, which you can't say anymore. It's now neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Or Alzheimer's, tons of novels and books about Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So the problem is you're inundated with books that are going to be about one of those topics or something like that. Or it's like Madeline Miller, who, you know, Circe and Song of Achilles. Those books that, and now other people write books and they do the same covers that Madeline had on her book. And it's Greek mythology and fictionalizing it, usually with a woman heroine who was always considered a monster in the past, like the one about Medusa, Medusa's sisters. Those are really, really popular. And how do you ride, you know, because yes, what we're talking about is success and economic success. How do you ride the waves that come periodically? Because they do.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's you mentioned Alzheimer's. My dad actually has Alzheimer's. And I know that, you know, like for the New York Times, a lot of people pitch stories about Alzheimer's. But yeah. I pitched one with a particular spin. And that was that I sang to my dad because I had studied voice for opera. And I always connected with him with music. And because studies show, this is scientifically proven, that music connects with a deeper part of the brain that accesses the memories of just that time and place for music. And they've shown videos, and actually I included in my story a video of a woman who was completely out of it with Alzheimer's, and they played music from her youth. She had been a ballerina. And she was actually livened up. And so that's what happened when I would sing to my dad. And I wrote about that, but it was a specific spin. So if there are books on Alzheimer's, right, it's going to be hard. You have to break through. So you have to be A, somebody who has the latest and greatest information on Alzheimer's, right? That's one way to do it. You've talked to, you know, the top researchers in Alzheimer's. If you're a journalist and you have that information, you would probably be interested in a book like that because it would be the latest and greatest.
Let me interrupt you, because what you said is so evocative to me. So my mom, when she was 96 and she was in the skilled nursing facility, she was still with it, and we laughed and sang. She and I sang together, usually country music, which I don't like, but she loved. Zac Brown Band, like Chicken Fried. she loved Chicken Fried. But we would go to the like rec room that they had, and there's a piano there. And she sat down. I didn't even know she'd ever played the piano. And she played perfectly the piece that she had learned when she was like 8 years old. And I was crying, but she played it perfectly. So just when you said that, that would mean I would buy that because it was evocative to me.
It resonated for you. And that's what writing, and that's what the writing is. And then you were saying about like in the bookstore, and I think you want the latest and the greatest. You want maybe a celebrity who had experience with, you know, Alzheimer's in a different way. You have to look at what's going to get noticed, right? Like you might have five people who would want to write about Alzheimer's, but out of those, what would get the most attention from the people and why? And a spin, a different spin. Maybe if somebody had a different spin, they correlated autism and they found research supporting it to early teaching in school. I don't know, early education, a certain way of learning, right? It's possible. And so that's kind of, I think it's a way that people have to start thinking about writing, about reading. And that's one of the things that I try to have come across with the book.
I'll give you a perfect example. I still practice law. I do medical negligence and personal injury, but I probably shouldn't because I'm kind of losing it myself at 71. But I have this case in which there was a delayed concussion syndrome. And then the gentleman got a tumor on his kidney. He was a cancer survivor already. And the tumor luckily turned out to be benign. But I was researching it and I found out there's all these articles now about stress and anxiety causing tumors and cancerous tumors. And I was thinking, okay, that would be a subject line. So that would be something that's not, it's kind of morbid, but it's something people would be interested in, because I never thought about that.
Yeah, it's, I've seen, because I wrote health and medical work, and I also took a stint in medical education, and inflammation creates disease, you know, it leads to disease. So inflammation, so it's, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert, don't quote me on it, but I have written and quoted other experts who have talked about that.
And also the other thing, when I was talking about Elon Musk, because this is the way he does his SpaceX, is that guy, Earl Nightingale, that you quoted, is basically saying failure is the best thing you can possibly do, is fail fast, succeed fast. That's the Silicon Valley thing.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little struggle with that, but I do agree.
Well, you wrote it. You put it in there.
I know. I mean, I think I'm not advocating that everybody, like, you know, blow up their life and fail in a spectacularly big and horrible way, but little failures that are going to build character, I think. Yeah. I wouldn't tell my daughter who's in high school, oh, ruin your first year of high school. That's okay. I would never tell her that. But I understand. Earl Nightingale, you know, his premise was to support people in their personal growth. And so what he said does make sense. And I think everything, like in life, within reason, right?
Well, you did say it's basically that idea, you know, write. And you said, you know, if you write junk, you're going to write. It's going to be crappy the first. And don't try and write it and be finished with it. You know, this is my, this is my book. It's done.
Yeah. Don't like write it and be like, oh, it's 3 a.m. You're like, that's the best thing ever. Send, you know, sleep.
I've done that. Now I've learned to, all my emails go into the draft box and they stay overnight.
Yeah.
I never hit send until I wait 24 hours.
You know what I do, Sam? And I talk about in the book, I email it to myself first.
I do too. I just did today.
Yep, I love it because it's such a difference. And then I open it, like, I'm like, and I'm reading, I'm like, oh my God, how did that get in there? Some clunky, weird thing. And you fix it, and then you can fix it. And also, I would not send anything, like, you know, late at night. I think late at night is just, you're tired. It's, you know, depending what's going on in your life, I would just wait. And also, it could get lost in someone's email box, right? All the stuff from the night before and the early morning. So I would just wait.
That's right. I never thought of that. It's very true. The other thing that I impress as much as I can on my son and my nephews, who they totally disagree with me, is to proofread and then to have someone else proofread it. Because if I get a resume that has an error on it, I will not hire the person. That's it.
Yeah.
I will not interview them.
Well, it's a bookstore. Like, they have to have some sort of appreciation. But you know what? You have to have somebody else look at it these days. You have Grammarly. You have grammarlookup.com. I mean, you could just go through that. Even on Microsoft, there's a grammar checker. So I think there's so many
But if
ways.
if you're a sloth, you don't do that. And my nephew says to me,
yeah,
you know, like when you're texting, that's what it is. When you're texting, Michael says, don't correct your, he goes, I hate when you correct the word the next time. I said, I can't help it. I was an English literature major. I can't help it. And Spencer, my nephew, goes, well, did you understand what I said? And I go, yeah. And he goes, well, why would I correct it then?
But that's texting. Nobody takes texting seriously. Like, who's going to, everything auto-corrects anyway. I'm texting and it changes, like, my last name. I'm like, what? That's not my name.
I know. It's horrible. But, you know, we're working for text. It's not working for us.
Exactly.
There's a lot of things like that in technology now. Why are you typing? Why are you even typing your email address anymore? You've typed it 100,000 times in your life.
It should be like an automatic thing. And there's a key. I just haven't figured it out yet.
I'm too old. I'm like the grandfather.
But you know, now there's, I don't know if you've seen this on LinkedIn. If you want to post, it says, would you like AI to create this for you, or chat to create a few. And I'm like, what? No.
Well, that's the thing, is now ChatGPT is taking over your job because it can generate pitches. It's not your job, but it can generate pitches that are as good as most pitches out there.
Yeah. I think chat could help be helpful as a tool, but because it is not accurate, like if you look yourself up, you'll see, you know, I'll see all sorts of places that I purportedly won awards for or wrote for, and it's just not correct. You know, go to estellasarazas.com. There's my bio. You can see it all, but it's like, no, ChatGPT won't get that. Not yet. It may. I mean, I think it's going to be improving and improving, you know, and I think I think it's a tool. If a writer can look at it as kind of like a VA to help with some of the tasks, and then you have to vet everything yourself. You still have to be your own fact checker. I'm a big believer in that.
And that's true of what you've done. When I look up your name, you've pitched yourself very well. And if you can do that, great. But if you can't do it, hire someone that can do it for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Make sure that you know how to support I mean, look, we're a world of packaging, right? Like, you know, you have to look at the packaging. So you want to present yourself. It's what our parents told us. It's what our grandparents told us. Present your best self forward, whether that's social media and your writing and your work and how you come across with somebody. You just want to show your best self, I think.
You know, I hate the idea that you ask some kid what they do for a living and they say, I'm an influencer. And I hate that, but it's true. And then, you know, you have someone like Kylie Jenner or Kendall Jenner, whichever one it is, who becomes a self-made billionaire, a billionaire doing just that.
You know, this is so funny that you said this because I don't know when, you know, when my daughter went to, I think it was her first day of school, people were saying what they want to do. And somebody said, I want to have a YouTube channel. It's not that hard, but I guess they wanted a, you know, multi-million follower YouTube channel. That's a little bit different, but, you know, there's still work involved in anything. I mean, you've seen all these depressed YouTubers writing about how much work they have to do. So, I mean, there's still work. Whatever you're doing, there's still work involved. You got to do the work.
There is something about what's happening to our culture in that the primary reason, I say everybody's a kid because they are compared to me, but it's like you want to be noticed. You want attention. You want everybody to either like you or to retweet you. Retweeting is like, it makes you feel inherently valuable.
Yeah. I don't think I want everyone to like me. I want to be respected for my work and valued for what I have to say. Right. I think that's different than saying I want to be liked. You know, you like me, you really like me.
I don't think that way, but I think a lot of people do, and that's why, I hate to say it, but that's why teen suicide is such an epidemic, because when people don't like you or pick on you or bully you, like you are, then you've been devalued.
Well, you know, for me, I wanted my daughter to, you know, understand that she isn't going to be influenced, you know, as much as possible by other people, because she had value in her ideas. And so that was an important part of the role playing that I did, that I wrote about in my article for the Times and for the Week and for the Washington Post and for all the places I've written. But I do think it's really important that that start early, that you're teaching your children that they have agency and autonomy. And it, you know, I've written about this also, you know, that her body is her own. When she was being, you know, when I had a babysitter diapering her, I would tell the babysitter to tell her what she was doing, not just like, I'm just going to silently diaper you, but okay, now we're raising your legs. Now I'm putting the powder on you, because she was a part of the process. So it's like creating this, the selfhood of the person. You know, I know we're getting esoteric here, but I sense you like that.
Well, actually, the next question I was going to ask you is, how does your daughter feel about the fact that she's out there and she's been written about by you so much? Does she yell at you? Does she tease?
No, she actually really loves it. But it's really funny. One day, I think it was last year, she was in a class and they were going online and getting information. She just did like a little search for my name and all the articles came out with the pictures of her. But they were pictures of her when she was little. She's a teenager now. I am not sharing anything or any pictures of her as a teenager. I'm very private about that. In fact, when I was on Good Morning America and they said, oh, do you have a recent picture of your daughter? I said, no, I will show. And they said, oh, can your daughter come on with you? And I said, no, I didn't even give her that option. And I said, I will share a picture of her when she was the age that I wrote the story about, but I'm not going to share a recent picture. So I did take measures to protect my daughter.
Yeah, and I think that's fairly logical, very logical. But I don't know if a lot of people do that. Well, they don't. Look at Facebook, Instagram. Yeah, I mean, look at Instagram. It's horrible.
I know.
A good way to wind down, I think, would be, and this is because I already knew this quote, it's Albert Einstein, and it's the idea of imagination being worth more than knowledge.
Yes, I love that one. Because
yeah, I know. Let's end on that. Talk about why you think that's so important.
I mean, imagination is, you know, when you think about the people that were imprisoned in war, right? What got them through was their imagination, their ability to think of a different world or a different time or a different place or how they would be and what will be in front of them. And that's imagination. That's using creativity. And I think that is the key. You can have a lot of, you know, they've done studies that the book smart people that are just book smart, they are not necessarily going to excel at life because that is not the knowledge that way is not the only way to make a go of it. And so I think imagination opens the door. And, you know, when people read a book in your bookstore, they're opening a portal to another place, another time, another perspective, another viewpoint, and it takes them away just in a gentle, but also, and it's also like they can learn. So the imagination can open the door to knowledge as well. So I think it's a win-win.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I read your book on my iPad. I read most of my iPad because I can take notes. I can look up words, stuff like that. But there are so many people who come into the bookstore and they say, I have to hold the book in my hand. I feel like I'm holding the author, his mind in my hand. And I think that goes towards the same kind of imagination experience that you're talking about.
You know what? I feel that way too. I know I can read on my iPad. I know I can read on my phone. There's nothing like holding a book. I'm just old school that way, Sam. I love a book.
I hear those exact words, that phrase, maybe 5 to 6 times a day.
And that's why if you looked around, I'm surrounded by books. I love books.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of having a bookstore is, like I said, can't be about the money. It's about making people happy, and like you and I are doing today, making them laugh too. Big deal.
Yes, absolutely. And finding a way to just expand our minds.
Yeah, which is not I'm always fatalistic. I don't see it happening as much as it should be happening in the world today, but the lesson is exactly right. You're saying exactly the right thing. So anyway, I loved your book. It's on the front table. It's been out since June. And there's the cover right there. And I look forward to, you know, pitching your book in this store. And now that I've learned how to pitch it better.
I love it. Thank you so much, Sam. It's been such a wonderful, flowing conversation with you. I've loved it.
Likewise. And it really helped that you gave me the outline with those quotes.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank you soon.